Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care, and he serves as the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed Chu welcomes Dr. Vincent DeVita, the Amy and Joseph Perella Professor of Medicine at Yale University. Dr. DeVita is also a former director of the National Cancer Institute and of Yale Cancer Center, and he joins Ed this evening to discuss the history of chemotherapy.
Chemotherapy was actually first coined as a word by Paul Ehrlich, a chemist who was well known around 1900 and in the early 1900s, and he defined it actually as using chemicals to treat syphilis. Now, his major contribution was he developed a rabbit model of human syphilis and developed a series of compounds, one of which was compound 606, salvarsan, which was actually used by the medical profession to treat syphilis. So it was sort of the birth of trying to find chemicals using animal models as screens so that you could treat a disease. And he actually had a wing in his laboratory where he did the same kind of work trying to find chemicals that might effectively treat cancer. He had a sign over the door that said, "Give up all hope, ye who enter." So he was not optimistic about the likelihood to find chemicals that would cure cancer, nor did he ever actually find one during his lifetime anyhow.
And when was chemotherapy first developed and then applied for use to treat patients with cancer?
Well, you know, there is an Egyptian papyrus that actually talks about using topical chemicals, herbs and extracts of herbs and so forth. So you can go as far back as you want. But it was really not until around the mid-1930s that people began to think you might realistically use chemicals for cancer. And actually, a first major screening program was started about 1935. But frankly, the date that people use for the birth of chemotherapy is 1943, and it was here at Yale when a group of people, based on experiences in World War I and then an accident in World War II with mustard gas, the data showed that people who died had atrophy of their bone marrow and their lymph nodes disappeared, and so it was thought that maybe they would be useful chemicals for treating a group of diseases called lymphoma, cancers of the lymph nodes. And they actually, Alfred Gilman here and Gustav Lingskog, who was a thoracic surgeon at the time, used an animal model of lymphoma and screened these chemicals, and they found that it actually worked. And so they convinced Dr. Lingskog, who had a patient who was having trouble breathing from big, large tumor masses in their neck, to let them test it. This is before the FDA would be involved in these things, and they got a very dramatic response. And that started the whole real interest in cancer chemotherapy. That paper was not published until 1946 because of the war, secrecy of the war gas program. But it's generally regarded as the beginning of human cancer chemotherapy.
Yeah, it is interesting, as you just commented on, that it came out of kind of the chemical warfare program that we, in fact, had here in this country.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, later, in 1955, because of the interest of nitrogen mustard and then another drug that was developed called methotrexate, which is also, by the way, worked on here at Yale by Joe Bertino and people like you in your lab, was a national cancer chemotherapy national service center was started in 1955, which was a national program to begin to screen chemicals for cancer in a major way. So that's the birth of chemotherapy here led to the development of a national screening program.
Now, what's fascinating to me, as I learn more about the history of cancer chemotherapy, in large part, you know, having had the privilege and honor of working closely with you, is that the whole concept of cancer chemotherapy was not really widely embraced when these first discoveries and treatments of patients with cancer came about.
Yeah, you're being very polite. It wasn't widely embraced. In fact, the critics were vitriolic about it. There was something about the self-fulfilling prophecy. Cancer is a fatal disease, and so it's a fatal disease, you don't treat it. If you don't treat it, it's indeed a fatal disease. So people just didn't believe you could ever cure cancer with drugs. And one other thing is nitrogen mustard worked, but it worked very briefly. And the people who were involved in developing nitrogen mustard became harsh critics of cancer chemotherapy because they were so disappointed after getting their hopes up that they were going to finally have a drug that would cure cancer that they never believed ever that you could cure cancer with drugs. And the original pioneers, the people who started using chemotherapy early, the most original of the pioneers, probably Alfred Gellhorn, who was the director of a cancer center attached to Columbia University called the Delafield Cancer Center, were basically run out of town. He was told, I interviewed him at age 94 last November. He passed away just a month or so ago. I interviewed him in his office. He was working at age 94. He told me about the great Robert Loeb, who was the chairman of medicine at Columbia. And he was a great man. He was a great teacher and a great academician. He said Loeb used to say to him in front of people at rounds, Alfred, you're part of the lunatic fringe. Hmm. The impact of having someone of Loeb's stature say something like that, even if it was partly in jest, was really enormous. Eventually, he was actually run out of Delafield Hospital, and it was closed because people didn't like the idea of cancer patients being treated and having their house staff being exposed to this. And there are many other examples of that kind of thing happening. But
so what turned things around in the evolution of cancer chemotherapy?
Well, I think, you know, it needed some evidence that you could cure cancer, and it was provided by two diseases, childhood leukemia and Hodgkin's disease. Okay, the drugs, more than one drug became available, and work was done in childhood leukemia combining several drugs, and one of which was the drug vincristine, which just became available in the late 1950s. And the first program that was developed that was quite successful was one called VAMP. VAMP, the initials stand for the drugs in the program. And it increased the remission rate in leukemia to about 50%. But the striking thing was that these people now stayed in remission for long periods of time. So by 1970, people were saying you could cure childhood leukemia. At the same time, we were doing the work on Hodgkin's disease and developed the MOP program, and the complete remission rate went from virtually zero to about 80%. And I'm just doing the 40-year follow-up on that original study. And, you know, we have 55% of the original group of patients are alive 40 years later. So that we, by 1970, it was also apparent that Hodgkin's disease was very likely cured by chemotherapy. That provided the spark that had been missing. And then what happened after that, which is a very important thing, was that people were now willing to test drugs in the postoperative period for patients whose tumor had been removed, but we knew they would have a high risk of recurrence, particularly in breast cancer and particularly in colorectal cancer. And so the early studies in what we now call adjuvant therapy came right on the heels of that, adjuvant to surgery. And, of course, these studies have been brilliantly positive. The mortality rates from both colorectal cancer and breast cancer are falling. At least 50% of the decline in mortality is due to the application of chemotherapy as an adjuvant therapy to surgery. So I think the big impetus was the what I call the concept of cure, that you could actually cure cancer with drugs.
And I guess really, the important concept was that combination chemotherapy was really essential to enable that cure to
indeed,
happen.
Indeed. And that, of course, it was a dirty word in medicine at the time. And if you gave combinations of antibiotics, for example, you were considered a sloppy practitioner. So combination chemotherapy was not something that was accepted at the time. And I worked with the two founders in this field, and I watched them be criticized in unbelievably vitriolic ways. When I got to Yale, I used to talk about their work, and there was no acceptance of that at Yale either, because it was just something that was not done. The important message here, however, Ed, is that now that we have targeted therapies, that it looks to me, and I would debate this with anybody who thinks otherwise, looks to me that combination chemotherapy is still required, that cancer is such a complex derangement that you need to target more than one pathway. Very rare exceptions, perhaps the disease chronic myelocytic leukemia treated with Gleevec maybe being the only exception I know of. It has one abnormality, so you can treat the one abnormality.
Right.
You take cancers like cancer of the pancreas, there are about 12 different key abnormalities, and you're going to have to make combination. It'll be a different kind of combination chemotherapy, but the principle is the same.
Yeah, and I think as we're now seeing this era of targeted therapy, and perhaps we can talk more a little about that later, maybe in the second part of the show, is that it does look like you need maybe combinations of target therapies and combinations of target therapies in combination with chemotherapy
yeah.
to perhaps have the greatest effect on killing the tumor cells.
Yeah, absolutely, because most of what the targeted therapy does that we see now is it resets, as I don't know whether your audience is aware of the name of the word apoptosis, which means cell death, cell suicide. We have built-in mechanisms in our body for cells to commit suicide when they're no longer functional. For example, we're born, or we are as an embryo, we have webs between our fingers, and we're not born with webs between our fingers normally, because these mechanisms make sure that the cells that are not needed any longer in those areas die. And so every cell in the body has an apoptotic mechanism. A lot of the targeted therapies actually reset that mechanism so that when you now damage it with chemotherapy, the cell commits suicide. So the combination of a targeted therapy and chemotherapy is going to be part of, you know, the future for combination chemotherapy. The problem we have with that is that all the regulations in the Food and Drug Administration process is contrary to allowing you to do that kind of thing. So that it's very difficult to develop these innovative therapies today. It's not history, but it's an interesting point, mm-hmm. is that there's a study coming out very shortly looking at the time it takes for a protocol to be approved to go through the process at a cancer center, at the National Cancer Institute, and the FDA, and the number of days if you want to guess, you'll never get it right on is 800 days.
Wow.
800 days. And in some cases, 1,000 days, which means that the study that you're starting that was approved, that was written 800 or 1,000 days ago, the day you started, it's out of date.
Yeah.
So we have a logistical problem that's as large as the problem of trying to solve, you know, how cancer cells grow and how you can kill them.
Okay. Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to canceranswers@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC. At this time, we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about the history of cancer chemotherapy with our special guest, Dr. Vincent DeVita from the Yale Cancer Center.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2008, there'll be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and about 2,400 patients are diagnosed annually here in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. But when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm here in the studio this evening with our special guest expert, Dr. Vincent DeVita, discussing the history of cancer chemotherapy. So, Vince, before the break, you were mentioning how long it now takes in order for a protocol to even get up and running, let alone actually help us get an answer to whether or not a particular treatment actually works for a particular cancer. I think what's really quite fascinating to me, having been a product of the National Cancer Institute, having been one of your fellows when you were director at the NCI, was a very different place that allowed these clinical trials to get up and running in a very timely fashion and to actually get finished and get us some really key answers. I mean, what, in your view, was the special qualities about the NCI, and what made it so special about being able to allow us to get answers that we really need for our patients?
That's a very important question, Ed, because I think in the answer to that question is the description of what we should be doing now, and there's a way of doing it now. Okay, for example, cancer centers were designed in the National Cancer Act, the War on Cancer, to play a special role in the War on Cancer. Well, what was the NCI? What was the strength of the NCI? Well, we were limited primarily by what was between our ears. Okay, if we had ideas, we could act on the ideas very quickly. We didn't have to get approval for a protocol modification that was something that could be handled internally at the National Cancer Institute. So we could make modifications very quickly. quickly. And what now takes 800 days would take less than a week at the Cancer Institute. So we could develop new therapies, modify them on the run, and in fact come up with very novel ways of doing things. I look at the young people now and I say, I just don't understand even why they want to do this, because you can't spend 800 days while your protocol is being approved somewhere. I think what needs to be done is the Food and Drug Administration and the National Cancer Institute need to delegate the responsibility for protocol development and approval for early trials to the cancer centers to an internal review mechanism so that you can move around very, very quickly. All these new therapies we have, there's a wonderful book, by the way, by Robert Weinberg on the biology of cancer. In the back of the book, he has a large chart. And the chart, I love to use it. You hold it up, it's the most complicated thing in the entire world. I mean, he did it for a reason. We know a huge amount about the signaling pathways in cancer cells. When you look at it, you realize how complicated it is for us to do anything to interfere with these signaling pathways. We need to be able to use the scientific talent at a cancer center to be able to make modifications to treatment regimens to block various pathways. And when they don't work, we need to be able to make another modification very quickly to adjust the treatment. You cannot do that by having the protocol submitted back to Washington, to the Cancer Institute, back to the Food and Drug Administration. Now, somebody might say, and I'm sure they will, that Dr. DeVita, aren't you concerned about patient safety? I am concerned about patient safety. I think we're not doing something safely for cancer patients when we make them wait 800 days for our next best idea. So we're in a very difficult situation, and the model from years ago would be a very good model for us to do and use again to readjust the environment of cancer centers like Yale and Harvard and so on. We have a lot of talent at these places, and we're not using it as effectively in this modern age with all the knowledge we have.
Now, you mentioned the National Cancer Act, which you played a key role when you were director of the National Cancer Institute. And obviously, one of the key features of the National Cancer Act was to have these NCI-designated cancer centers around the country. And I think one thing that maybe is confusing to a lot of listeners out there, certainly here in the state of Connecticut, they hear about various community centers that call themselves cancer centers. But clearly there's a difference, there's a distinction, and maybe you can help our listeners kind of go through that.
Sure. I mean, I have had the privilege of dedicating a number of cancer centers, including other ones here in New Haven at St. Raphael's Hospital. What I always point out is, you know, the community cancer centers have a responsibility for delivering the state-of-the-art therapy for those particular tumors. The cancer centers that were approved and developed by the NCI, like Yale, have been responsible for developing the state-of-the-art therapy so that, you know, being at a cancer center like Yale brings you closer to the newest development. And since cancer is an evolving field, you want to stay as close to that if you have a cancer that is not easily treated at the present time. So what you have, and I think this has been a benefit of the Cancer Act, the community cancer centers sprang up because there was a state-of-the-art that was developed, and national mortality rates have come down, you know, for a lot of cancers, and survival rates have improved because we've been able to take the information from cancer centers and spread it out into the community. But there's a major difference. The difference is one develops the therapy, the other delivers it. And in the process of developing it, you deliver it. Okay, so the Yale Cancer Center has to deliver state-of-the-art treatment. But in the process of doing that, we also have studies that look at modifying the state-of-the-art therapy to take advantage of the new biology. So there are lots of examples where, for example, when we developed MOP, it took 11 years fully. There's a nice paper published on this subject. It took 11 years for full dissemination of MOP into the community, because that was now 1967 through 1971. So we didn't have all those community cancer centers out there now. Now a modification of a protocol that's advantageous to the patient can be disseminated very quickly.
So, and as you've always taught me, translational research is really kind of the key to making new discoveries and bringing new treatment strategies into the clinic. Maybe you can tell our listeners out there, what does translational research mean to you?
I haven't the foggiest notion. I'm being facetious, because I think translational research is the current buzzword.
Right.
So that right now, when I review grants, I never see a grant that isn't translational research presented to me as translational research. But basically, I think what we're trying to say is that ultimately you have to test new things in patients. There's a friend of mine in Boston who always made the rather crude statement that the said when he saw a mouse with cancer, he would step on it. That mouse models don't predict well for humans, so you have to eventually do your studies in humans. So taking basic information and designing studies in humans is the ultimate in translational research. But most scientists in the lab now who are doing something they think may be relevant will tell you they're doing translational research as well. So it's a very broad definition that primarily means let's try to get something out there to help people. You know,
I think one of the exciting aspects these days for those of us who are involved in cancer drug development is the ability to work very closely with the pharmaceutical companies,
yes,
which I think is maybe a bit different than when you were developing MOP chemotherapy back in the late 60s and early 70s.
Well, there was no pharmaceutical industry in those days. We were the pharmaceutical industry. We had the National Cancer Institute Drug Development Program. It was Bristol-Myers Squibb, the company that began to put money into investing into anti-cancer drugs. And they did some heroic stuff, and they came out with some very good drugs, including the drug Taxol. I think they do a very good job, and I think we go a little bit overboard the other way in trying to avoid conflict of interest in putting ourselves at arm's length with pharmaceutical companies. And I think we need to stay close to them. We can't at Yale, and Harvard can't at Harvard, and Duke can't at Duke, and Hopkins can't at Hopkins do what the pharmaceutical industry does. They have the capacity to develop the drugs, to do the toxicology, to market the drugs. We don't. And so we need to have a partnership with them, and I think we just have to be careful about the extent of that partnership.
And I think that's an important point that you raise, because I think unfortunately, you know, with all the press and the media hoopla, pharmaceutical companies tend to get a bad rap,
yeah,
and a very bad reputation, yeah, which I think sometimes is quite unfair.
It is unfair. I think I think I've mentioned this to you before. I have a pet peeve, and that is, you know, when you read about these drugs that are new targeted therapies, monoclonal antibodies, the cost of them can be as much as $100,000 a year, which is a lot of money. That's why people pick on the pharmaceutical companies. But then you hear that, you know, they're tested in cancer patients and they only prolong life by about 3 months. And the public rightly says, jeepers, you pay $100,000 a year, you get a three-month prolongation of life. But what is not often said in these articles is that you're testing it in patients with advanced cancer, mm-hmm, where it's beneficial and it is expensive. When you take the same therapy and put it in the postoperative period when there are fewer cancer cells and the patient can be cured, you may actually only require about $30,000 worth of drug, and then the patient's alive for the rest of their normal life. So that when the transition is always from the expensive and a little bit helpful but not terribly helpful in advanced cancer to less expensive curative approaches in people with early stage disease. So I wish when the stories came out in the newspapers about these big bad companies charging $100,000, first of all, it costs about $800 million to develop a drug and get it to the market, that they would give the other side of the story. And it's happening in breast cancer. It's happening in colorectal cancer.
Right, I was just going to say that actually my own area in colorectal cancer, where, again, you know, the initial approaches were to treat metastatic disease, we're now actually moving that kind of in the adjuvant setting after surgery and finding remarkable
results.
I'd say
national mortality for colorectal cancer has plummeted in the last couple of decades. By the way, even in advanced disease, as invariably happens, you're now starting to see patients with metastatic disease go into a complete remission, and some of those are lasting a long time, and I think you're coming to the point where you will see your ability to cure patients with metastatic cancer. But keep in mind, breast cancer, 90% of the time, presents as local disease. So when you develop these therapies an advanced disease, and then you apply them in the local situation, mm-hmm, you're dealing with the great majority of the population. And that's why mortality rates from breast cancer are coming down in this country as well. So, I think we need to be careful, but I think the pharmaceutical industry in this country is marvelous, and the world owes them a great debt of gratitude. And I think we should continue to work with them, because we can't do what we have to do without them. So.
And I think it's fair to say that the pharmaceutical companies, they're quite smart, and they partner up with the cancer center programs that they feel give them the best chance.
Yeah, they don't have the same science that we have. I mean, they can't afford to invest into that kind of scientific program. So they need the scientific input, and we can't. It's inefficient for a cancer center to invest in large-scale toxicology chemistry programs to develop drugs. And so we now use them. The Cancer Institute did that for centers for a long time, but it's largely done now by the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm. just a minor switch in topics. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you're the senior author of the definitive text in oncology called Principles and Practice of Oncology, PPO, now in its eighth edition. And obviously, this is viewed as the Bible by all of us who practice oncology. How did you what made you decide to actually write this book?
Yeah, well, it just came out last week, the eighth edition, so we're very pleased. It's a very beautiful book. We were looking at the field, and we noticed that textbooks came out for surgeries, textbooks came out for medical oncology, textbooks came out for radiotherapy, but there was not one textbook that said, this is cancer, and you know, let's put it all together in one package. So I sat down with my colleague, Steve Rosenberg, who's the chief of surgery at the Cancer Institute, and we convinced Sam Hellman, who, by the way, was trained here at Yale, but at that time was at Harvard, he's one of the preeminent radiotherapists in the country. We sat down and decided we would do the book. And I remember Sam Hellman's comment when I asked him, he said, are you out of your mind? Because it was obviously going to take a lot of time and effort. And since the first edition, it's been very popular because I think it filled a need. And we like to think, we're slightly biased, but we like to think that national mortality rates have been nudged down by making information available to all oncologists in a very good textbook. And now there are other books that are doing the same sort of thing. And I think it's delightful to see the book doing so well. For me, it keeps me sane because, you know, what it does is it forces me to look at the entire field. And we only have a year or so between editions, so you're constantly looking at what's changing when you're putting together the new editions and getting new authors and making sure that all the new information is in a text. So it's been a delightful experience. Now I measure my life in editions, I wouldn't change working on the text really for much. But
so in the last minute or so, Vince, so you've got great perspective. Where do you see the landscape now of cancer therapy heading, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, my personal feeling, and I've said this publicly, and is that I think that we have in hand a critical mass of usable knowledge. What I mean by that is I think we have enough information to really do what we need to do for most cancers. The problem is, as I said, that big diagram in the back of Bob Weinberg's book is very, very complicated, and sorting it out and putting it together in effective ways to prevent cancer, diagnose cancer, and treat cancer is very complicated. And we need to be able to develop the machinery to do that. We paid $55 billion for this information in terms of support for the cancer program. And that is right now is a problem that I'm approaching. We have a grant that's under review at the moment to look at the structure of cancer centers and look at the regulatory agencies and their interaction to see if there is a way we can change things so that we can make use of this knowledge and move very fast. If we do, I think the next 10 years are going to bring startling revelations. We're going to see tumors we never thought would fall, it'll happen anyhow, but it'll happen at a greater rate of speed if we can build the flexibility into our programs.
Well, Vince, as always, it's been great having you on the show to hear your perspectives, and we look forward to having you come back and kind of have a follow-up session.
Okay, Ed, thanks.
Until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we look at the latest information on kidney cancer with Drs. Harriet Kluger and Edward Uccio. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.